Track 1.
Nicholas Berg stepped out of the taxi onto the floodlit dock and paused to look up at the Warlock. At this state of the tide, she rode high against the stone quay, so that even though the cranes towered above her, they did not dwarf her. Despite the exhaustion that fogged his mind and cramped his muscles until they ached, Nicholas felt a stir of the old pride, the old sense of value achieved as he looked at her. She looked like a warship, sleek and deadly, with the high, flared bows and good lines that combined to make her safe in any seaway. The superstructure was molded steel and glittering armored glass, behind which her lights burned in carnival array. The wings of her navigation bridge swept back elegantly and were covered to protect the men who must work in her in the cruelest weather and most murderous seas. Overlooking the wide stern deck was the second navigation bridge, from which a skilled seaman could operate the great winches and drums of cable, could catch and control the hawser on the hydraulically operated rising fairleads, could baby a wallowing oil rig or a mortally wounded liner in a gale or a silky calm. Against the night sky, high above it all, the twin towers replaced the squat single funnel of the old-fashioned salvage tugs, and the illusion of a man-of-war was heightened by the fire cannons on the upper platforms from which the Warlock could throw 1,500 tons of seawater an hour onto a burning vessel. From the towers themselves could be swung the boarding ladders over which men could be sent aboard a hulk, and between them was painted the small circular target that marked the miniature heliport. The whole of it, hull and upper decks, was fireproofed so that she could survive in the inferno of burning petroleum from a hold tanker or the flaming chemical from a bulk carrier. Nicholas Berg felt a little of the despondency and spiritual exhaustion slough away, although his body still ached and his legs carried him stiffly, like those of an old man, as he started towards the gangplank. The hell with them all, he thought. I built her, and she is strong and good. Although it was an hour before midnight, the crew of the Warlock watched him from every vantage point they could find. Even the oilers had come up from the engine room when the word reached them, and now loafed unobtrusively on the stern working deck. David Allen, the first officer, had placed a hand at the main harbour gates with a photograph of Nicholas Berg and a 5-cent piece for the telephone call box beside the gate, and the whole ship was alerted now. David Allen stood with the chief engineer in the glassed wing of the main navigation bridge, and they watched the solitary figure pick his way across the shadowy dock, carrying his own case. That's him. David's voice was husky with awe and respect. He looked like a schoolboy under his saggy bush of sun-bleached hair. He's a bloody film star. Vinnie Baker, the chief engineer, hitched up his sagging trousers with both elbows, and his spectacles slid down his long, thin nose as he snorted, "A bloody film star." He repeated the term with utmost scorn. He was first to Jules Lavoisin, David pointed out, and again the note of awe as he intoned that name. And he's a tugman from way back. That was 15 years ago. Vinnie Baker released his elbow grip on his trousers and pushed his spectacles up onto the bridge of his nose. Immediately, his trousers began their slow but inexorable slide deckwards. Since then, he's become a bloody glamour boy and an owner. Yes, David Allen agreed. And his baby face crumpled a little at the thought of those two legendary animals, master and owner, combined in one monster. A monster which was on the point of mounting his gangway to the deck of Warlock. "You better go down and kiss him on the soft spot," Vinny grunted comfortably, and drifted away. Two decks down was the sanctuary of his control room, where neither masters nor owners could touch him. He was going there now. David Allen was breathless and flushed when he reached the entry port. The new master was halfway up the gangway, and he lifted his head and looked steadily at the mate as he stepped aboard. Though he was only a little above average, Nicholas Berg gave the impression of towering height, and the shoulders beneath the blue cashmere of his jacket were wide and powerful. He wore no hat, and his hair was very dark, very thick, and brushed back from a wide, unlined forehead. The head was big-nosed and gaunt-boned, with a heavy jaw, blue now with a new beard, and the eyes were set deep in the cages of their bony sockets, underlined with dark, plum-coloured smears, as though they were bruised. But what shocked David Allen was the man's pallor. His face was drained, as though he had been bled from the jugular. It was the pallor of mortal illness, or of exhaustion close to death itself, and was emphasized by the dark eye sockets. This was not what David had expected of the legendary Golden Prince of Christy Marine. It was not the face he had seen so often pictured in newspapers and magazines around the world. Surprise made him mute, and the man stopped and looked down at him. "Alan?" asked Nicholas Berg quietly. His voice was low and level, without accent, but with a surprising timbre and resonance. "Yes, sir. Welcome aboard, sir." When Nicholas Berg smiled, the edges of sickness and exhaustion smoothed away at his brow and at the corners of his mouth. His hand was smooth and cool, but his grip was firm enough to make David blink. "I'll show you to your quarters, sir." David took the Louis Vuitton suitcase from his grip. "I know the way," said Nick Berg. "I designed her." He stood in the center of the master's day cabin and felt the deck tilt under his feet. Although the Warlock was fast to the stone dock and the muscles in his thighs trembled. "The funeral went off all right?" Nick asked. "He was cremated, sir," David said. "That's the way he wanted it. I've made the arrangements for the ashes to be sent home to Mary. Mary is his wife, sir," he explained quickly. "Yes," said Nick Berg. "I know. I saw her before I left London. Mac and I were shipmates once. He told me. He used to boast about that." "Have you cleared all his gear?" Nick asked, and glanced around the master's suite. "Yes, sir. We've packed it all up. There's nothing of his left in here." "He was a good man." Nick swayed on his feet and looked longingly at the day couch. But instead he crossed to the port and looked out onto the dock. "How did it happen?" "My report..." "Tell me," said Nicholas Berg, and his voice cracked like a whip. "The main tow cable parted, sir. He was on the after deck. It took his head off like a bullwhip." Nick stood quietly for a moment, thinking about that terse description of tragedy. He had seen a tow part under stress once before. That time, it had killed three men. "All right." Nick hesitated a moment. The exhaustion had slowed and softened him, so that for a moment he was on the point of explaining why he'd come to take command of Warlock himself, rather than sending another hired man to replace Mac. It might help to have somebody to talk to now, when he was right down on his knees, beaten and broken and tired to the very depths of his soul. He swayed again, then caught himself and forced aside the temptation. He had never whined for sympathy in his life before. "All right," he repeated. "Please give my apologies to your officers. I've not had much sleep in the last 2 weeks, and the flight out from Heathrow was murder, as always. I'll meet them in the morning. Ask the cook to send a tray with my dinner." The cook was a huge man who moved like a dancer in a snowy apron and a theatrical chef's cap. Nick Berg stared at him as he placed the tray on the table at his elbow. The cook wore his hair in a shiny, carefully coiffured bob that fell to his right shoulder, but was drawn back from the left cheek to display a small diamond earring in the pierced lobe of that ear. He lifted the cloth off the tray with a hand as hairy as that of a bull gorilla. But his voice was as lyrical as a girl's, and his eyelashes curled soft and dark onto his cheek. "That's a lovely bowl of soup and a pot au feu. It's one of my little special things. You will adore it," he said, and stepped back. He surveyed Nick Berg with those huge hands on his hips. "But I took one look at you as you came aboard, and I just knew what you really needed." With the magician's flourish, he produced a half bottle of Pinch Hague from the deep pocket of his apron. "Take a nip of that with your dinner, and then straight into bed with you, you poor dear." No man had ever called Nicholas Berg dear before, but his tongue was too thick and slow for the retort. He stared after the cook as he disappeared with a sweep of his white apron and the twinkle of the diamond, and then he grinned weakly and shook his head, weighing the bottle in his hand. "Damned if I don't need it," he muttered, and went to find a glass. He poured it half full and sipped it as he came back to the couch and lifted the lid of the soup pot. The steaming aroma made the little saliva glands under his tongue spurt. The hot food and whiskey in his belly taxed his last reserves, and Nicholas Berg kicked off his shoes as he staggered into his night cabin. He awoke with the anger on him. He had not been angry in 2 weeks, which was the measure of his despondency. But when he shaved, the mirrored face was that of a stranger still, too pale and gaunt and set. The lines that framed his mouth were too deeply chiselled, and the early sunlight through the port caught the dark hair at his temple, and he saw the frosty glitter there and leaned closer to the mirror. It was the first time he had noticed the flash of silver hair. Perhaps he had never looked hard enough, or perhaps it was something new. 40, he thought. I'll be 40 years old next June. He had always believed that if a man never caught the big one before he was 40, he was doomed never to do so. So what were the rules for the man who caught the big wave before he was 30 and rode it fast and hard and high, then lost it again before he was 40 and was washed out into the trough of boiling white water? Was he doomed also? Nick stared at himself in the mirror and felt the anger in him change its form, becoming directed and functional. He stepped into the shower and let the needles of hot water sting his chest. Through the tiredness and disillusion, he was aware, for the first time in weeks, of the underlying strength which he had begun to doubt was still there. He felt it rising to the surface in him, and he thought again of what an extraordinary sea creature he was, how it needed only a deck under him and the smell of the sea in his throat. He stepped from the shower and dried quickly. This was the right place to be now. This was the place to recuperate, and he realized that his decision not to replace Mac with a hired skipper had been a gut decision, He needed to be here himself. Always he had known that if you wanted to ride the big wave, you must first be at the place where it begins to peak. It's an instinctive thing. A man just knows where that place is. Nick Berg knew deep in his being that this was the place now. And with his rising strength, he felt the old excitement. The old, I'll show the bastard who is beaten excitement. And he dressed swiftly and went up the bastard's private companionway to the upper deck. Immediately, the wind flew at him and flicked his dark, wet hair into his face. It was Force 5 from the southeast, and it came boiling over the great, flat-topped mountain which crouched above the city and harbour. Nick looked up at it and saw the thick white cloud they called the tablecloth spilling off the heights and swirling along the grey rock cliffs. The Cape of Storms, he murmured. Even the water in the protected dock leaped and peaked into white crests, which blew away like wisps of smoke. The tip of Africa thrust southwards into one of the most treacherous seas on all the globe. Here, two oceans swept turbulently together off the rocky cliffs of Cape Point, and then roiled over the shallows of the Agulhas Bank. Here, wind opposed current in eternal conflict. This was the breeding ground of the freak wave, the one that mariners call the 100-year wave, because statistically, that was how often it should occur. But off the Agulhas Bank, it was always lurking, waiting only for the right combination of wind and current, waiting for the in-phase wave sequence to send its crest rearing 100 feet high and steep as those grey rock cliffs of Table Mountain itself. Nick had read the accounts of seamen who had survived that wave, and at a loss for words, they had written only of a great hole in the sea into which a ship fell helplessly. When the hole closed, the force of breaking water would bury her completely. Perhaps the Waratah Castle was one which had fallen into that trough. Nobody would ever know. A great ship of 9,000 tons burden, she and her crew of 211 had disappeared without trace in these seas. Yet, here was one of the busiest sea lanes on the globe, as a procession of giant tankers ploughed ponderously around that rocky cape on their endless shuttle between the Western world and the oil gulf of Persia. Despite their bulk, those supertankers were perhaps some of the most vulnerable vehicles yet designed by man. Now Nick turned and looked across the wind-ripped waters of Duncan Dock at one of them. He could read her name on the stern that rose like a 5-story department block. She was owned by Shell Oil, 250,000 deadweight tons, and out of ballast, she showed much of her rust-red bottom. She was in for repairs, while out in the roadstead of Table Bay, two other monsters waited patiently for their turn in the hospital dock. So big and ponderous and vulnerable and valuable. Nick licked his lips involuntarily. Hull and cargo together. She was $30 million, piled up like a mountain. That was why he had stationed the Warlock here at Cape Town on the southernmost tip of Africa. He felt the strength and excitement surging upwards in him. All right. So he'd lost his wave. He was no longer cresting and racing. He was down and smothered in white water. But he could feel his head breaking the surface, and he was still on the brake line. He knew there was another big wave racing down on him. It was just beginning to peak, and he knew he still had the strength to catch her, to get up high and race again. I did it once. I'll damn well do it again, he said aloud, and went down for breakfast. He stepped into the saloon, and for a long moment nobody realized he was there. There was an excited buzz of comment and speculation that absorbed them all. The chief engineer had an old copy of Lloyd's List folded at the front page and held above a plate of eggs as he read aloud. Nicholas wondered where he had found the ancient copy. His spectacles had slid right to the end of his nose, so he had to tilt his head far backwards to see through them, and his Australian accent twanged like a guitar. In a joint statement issued by the new chairman and incoming members of the board, a tribute was paid to the 15 years of loyal service that Mr. Nicholas Berg had given to Christy Marine. The five officers listened avidly, ignoring their breakfasts, until David Allen glanced up at the figure in the doorway. "Captain, sir," he shouted, and leapt to his feet, while with the other hand he snatched the newspaper out of Vinnie Baker's hands and bundled it under the table. "Sir, may I present the officers of Warlock?" Shuffling, embarrassed, the younger officers shook hands hurriedly and then applied themselves silently to their congealing breakfasts with a total dedication that precluded any conversation. While Nick Berg took the master's seat at the head of the long table in the heavy silence, and David Allen sat down again on the crumpled sheets of newsprint. The steward offered the menu to the new captain, and returned almost immediately with a dish of stewed fruit. "I ordered a boiled egg," said Nick mildly, and an apparition in snowy white appeared from the galley with the chef's cap at a jaunty angle. "The sailors curse his constipation, skipper. I look after my officers. The fruit is delicious and is good for you. I'm doing you your eggs now, dear, but eat your fruit first." And the diamond twinkled again as he vanished. Nick stared after him in the appalled silence. "Fantastic cook," blurted David Allen, his fair skin flushed pinkly and the Lloyd's List rustled under his backside. "Could get a job on any passenger liner, could Angel. If he ever left the Warlock, half the crew would go with him," growled the chief engineer darkly, and hauled at his pants with elbows below the level of the table. "And I'd be one of them." Nick Berg turned his head politely to follow the conversation. "He's almost a doctor," David Allen went on, addressing the chief engineer. 5 years at Edinburgh Medical School," agreed the chief solemnly. "Do you remember how he set the second's leg? Terribly useful to have a doctor aboard." Nick picked up his spoon and tentatively lifted a little of the fruit to his mouth. Every officer watched him intently as he chewed. Nick took another spoonful. "You should taste his jam, sir." David Allen addressed Nick directly at last. "Absolutely cordon bleu stuff." "Thank you, gentlemen, for the advice," said Nick. The smile did not touch his mouth, but crinkled his eyes slightly. "But would somebody convey a private message to Angel that if he ever calls me dear again, I'll beat that ridiculous cap down about his ears?" In the relieved laughter that followed, Nick turned to David Allen and sent colour flying to his cheeks again by asking, "You seem to have finished with that old copy of the List, number one. Do you mind if I glance at it again?" Reluctantly, David lifted himself and produced the newspaper. And there was another tense silence as Nick Berg rearranged the rumpled sheets and studied the old headlines without any apparent emotion. "The Golden Prince of Christy Marine deposed." Nicholas hated that name. It had been old Arthur Christie's quirk to name all his vessels with the prefix Golden, and 12 years ago, when Nick had rocketed to head of operations at Christie Marine. Some wag had stuck that label on him. Alexander to head the Christie Board of Directors. Nicholas was surprised by the force of his hatred for the man. They had fought like a pair of bulls for dominance of the herd, and the tactics that Duncan Alexander had used had won. Arthur Christie had said once, "Nobody gives a damn these days whether it is moral or fair. All that counts is, will it work, and can you get away with it?" For Duncan it had worked, and he'd got away with it in the grandest possible style. As managing director in charge of operations, Mr. Nicholas Berg helped to build Christie Marine from a small coasting and salvage company into one of the five largest owners of cargo shipping operating anywhere in the world. After the death of Arthur Christie in 1968, Mr. Nicholas Berg succeeded him as chairman and continued the company's spectacular expansion. At present, Christie Marine has in commission 11 bulk carriers and tankers, in excess of 250,000 deadweight tons, and has building the million-ton giant ultra-tanker Golden Dawn. It will be the largest vessel ever launched. There it was, stated in the baldest possible terms, the labor of a man's lifetime. Over $1 billion of shipping, designed, financed and built almost entirely with the energy and enthusiasm and faith of Nicholas Berg. Mr. Nicholas Berg married Miss Chantelle Christie, the only child of Mr. Arthur Christie. However, the marriage ended in divorce in September of last year, and the former Mrs. Berg has subsequently married Mr. Duncan Alexander, the new chairman of Christie Marine. He felt the hollow, nauseous feeling in his stomach again. In his head, the vivid image of the woman. He did not want to think of her now, but could not thrust the image aside. She was bright and beautiful as a flame, and like a flame, you could not hold her. When she went, she took everything with her. Everything. He should hate her also. He really should. Everything he thought again, the company, his life's work, and the child. When he thought of the child, he nearly succeeded in hating her, and the newsprint shook in his hand. He became aware again that five men were watching him, and without surprise, he realized that not a flicker of his emotions had shown on his face. To be a player for 15 years in one of the world's highest games of chance, inscrutability was a minimum requirement. In a joint statement issued by the new chairman and incoming members of the board, a tribute was paid. Duncan Alexander paid the tribute for one reason, Nick thought grimly. He wanted the 100,000 Christie Marine shares that Nick owned. Those shares were very far from a controlling interest. Chantelle had 1 million shares in her own name, and there were another 1 million in the Christie Trust. But insignificant as it was, Nick's holding gave him a voice and an entry to the company's affairs. Nick had bought and paid for every one of those shares. Nobody had given him a thing, not once in his life. He had taken advantage of every stock option in his contract, had bartered bonus and salary for those options. And now those 100,000 shares were worth $3 million. Meager reward for the labor which had built up a fortune of $60 million for the Christie father and daughter. It had taken Duncan Alexander almost a year to get those shares. He and Nicholas had bargained with cold loathing. They had hated each other from the first day that Duncan had walked into the Christie building on Leadenhall Street. He had come as old Arthur Christie's latest wunderkind. The financial genius, fresh from his triumphs as financial controller of International Electronics. And the hatred had been instant and deep and mutual. A fierce, smouldering chemical reaction between them. In the end, Duncan Alexander had won. He'd won it all, except the shares. And he had bargained for those from overwhelming strength. He had bargained with patience and skill, wearing his man down over the months. Using all Christie Marine's reserves to block and frustrate Nicholas, forcing him back step by step, taxing even his strength to its limits, driving such a bargain that at the end, Nicholas was forced to bow and accept a dangerous price for his shares. He had taken, as full payment, the subsidiary of Christie Marine, Christie Towage and Salvage, all its assets and all its debts. Nick had felt like a fighter who had been battered for 15 rounds and was now hanging desperately to the ropes with his legs gone, blinded by his own sweat and blood and swollen flesh. So he could not see from whence the next punch would come. But he held on just long enough. He had got Christie, Towage and Salvage. He had walked away with something that was completely and entirely his. Nicholas Berg lowered the newspaper, and immediately his officers attacked their breakfast ravenously, and there was the clatter of cutlery. "There is an officer missing," he said. "It's only the Trog, sir," Dave Allen explained.
"The Trog?"
"The radio officer, sir. Spears, sir. We call him the Troglodyte."
"I'd like all the officers present."
"He never comes out of his cave," Vinnie Baker explained helpfully.
"All right," Nick nodded. "I'll speak to him later."
They waited now, 5 eager young men. Even Vin Baker could not completely hide his interest behind the smeared lenses of his spectacles and the tough Aussie veneer.
"I wanted to explain to you the new setup. The chief has kindly read to you this article, presumably for the benefit of those who are unable to do so for themselves a year ago."
Nobody said anything, but Vin Baker fiddled with his porridge spoon. "So you are aware that I am no longer connected in any way with Christie Marine. I have now acquired Christie Towage and Salvage. It becomes a completely independent company. The name is being changed." Nicholas had resisted the vanity of calling it Berg Towage and Salvage. It will be known as Ocean Towage and Salvage. He had paid dearly for it, perhaps too dearly. He had given up his $3 million worth of Christie shares for God alone knew what. But he had been tired unto death. "We own 2 vessels, the Golden Warlock and her sister ship, which is almost ready for her sea trials, the Golden Witch." He knew exactly how much the company owed on those 2 ships. He had agonized over the figures through long and sleepless nights. On paper, the net worth of the company was around $4 million. He had made a paper profit of $1 million on his bargain with Duncan Alexander. But it was paper profit only. The company had debts of nearly $4 million more. If he missed just 1 month's interest payment on those debts, he dismissed the thought quickly. For on a forced sale, his residue in the company would be worth nothing. He would be completely wiped out. The names of both ships have been changed also. They will become simply Warlock and Sea Witch. From now onwards, Golden is a dirty word around Ocean Salvage. They laughed then, a release of tension, and Nick smiled with them, and lit a thin black cheroot from the crocodile skin case while they settled down. I will be running this ship in until Sea Witch is commissioned. It won't be long, and there will be promotions then. Nick superstitiously tapped the mahogany mess table as he said it. The dockyard strike had been simmering for a long time. Sea Witch was still on the ways, but costing interest, and further delay would prove him mortal. I've got a long oil rig tow, bite of Australia to South America. It'll give us all time to shake the ship down. You're all tugmen. I don't have to tell you when the big one comes up. There'll be no warning. They stirred, and the eagerness was on them again. Even the oblique reference to prize money had roused them. Chief, Nick looked across at him, and the engineer snorted as though the question was an insult. In all respects, ready for sea, he said, and tried simultaneously to adjust his trousers and his spectacles. Number one. Nick looked at David Allen. He had not yet become accustomed to the mate's boyishness. He knew that he had held a Master Mariner's ticket for 10 years, that he was over 30 years of age, and that MacDonald had hand-picked him. He had to be good. Yet that fair, unlined face and quick high colour under the unruly mop of blonde hair made him look like an undergraduate. "I'm waiting on some stores yet, sir," David answered quickly. "The Chandlers have promised for today, but none of it's vital. I could sail in an hour, if it's necessary." "All right." Nick stood up. "I will inspect the ship at 9 hours. You best get the ladies off the ship." During the meal, there had been the faint tinkle of female voices and laughter from the crew's quarters. Nick stepped out of the saloon, and Vin Baker's voice was pitched to reach him. It was a truly dreadful imitation of what the chief believed to be a Royal Naval accent. "0900, chaps. Jolly good show, what?" Nick didn't miss a step, and he grinned tightly to himself. It's an old Aussie custom. You needle and needle until something happens. There's no malice in it. It's just a way of getting to know your man. At once the boots and fists have stopped flying, you can be friends or enemies on a permanent basis. It was so long since he'd been in elemental contact with tough physical men, straight hard men, who shunned all subterfuge and sham, and he found the novelty stimulating. Perhaps that was what he really needed now, the sea, and the company of real men. He felt his step quicken, and the anticipation of physical confrontation lift his spirits off the bottom. He went up the companionway to the navigation deck, taking the steps three at a time, and the doorway opposite his suite opened. From it emerged the solid grey stench of cheap Dutch cigars and a head that could have belonged to some prehistoric reptile. It, too, was pale grey and lined and wrinkled. The head of a sea turtle, or an iguana lizard, with the same small, dark, glittery eyes. The door was that of the radio room. It had direct access to the main navigation bridge, and was merely 2 paces from the master's day cabin. Despite appearances, the head was human, and Nick recalled clearly how Mac had once described his radio officer. "He is the most antisocial bastard I've ever sailed with, but he can scan 8 different frequencies simultaneously, in clear and Morse, even while he's asleep. He is a mean, joyless, constipated son of a bitch, and probably the best radio man afloat." "Captain," said the Trog, in a reedy, petulant voice. Nick did not ponder the fact that the Trog recognized him instantly as the new master. The air of command on some men is unmistakable. "Captain, I have an all-ships signifier. Nick felt the heat at the base of his spine and the electric prickle on the back of his neck. It is not sufficient merely to be on the brake line when the big wave peaks. It is also necessary to recognize your wave from the 100 others that sweep by. Coordinates? He snapped as he strode down the passageway to the radio room. 72 degrees 16 south, 32 degrees 12 west. Nick felt the jump in his chest and the heat mount up along his spine. The high latitudes down there in the vast and lonely wastes. There was something sinister and menacing in the mere figures. What ship could go down there? The longitudinal coordinates fitted neatly in the chart that Nick carried in his mind, like a war chart in a military operations room. She was south and west of the Cape of Good Hope, down deep, beyond Gough and Bouvet Island in the Weddell Sea. He followed the trog into the radio room. On this bright, sunny and windy morning, the room was dark and gloomy as a cave, the thick green blinds drawn across the ports. The only source of light was the glowing dials of the banked communication equipment, the most sophisticated equipment that all the wealth of Christie Marine could pack into her. $100,000 worth of electronic magic, but the stink of cheap cigars was overpowering. Beyond the radio room was the operator's cabin, the bunk unmade, a tray of soiled dishes on the deck beside it. The trog hopped up into the swivel seat and elbowed aside a brass shell casing that acted as an ashtray and spilled grey flakes of ash and a couple of cold, wet, chewed cigar butts onto the desk. Like a wizened gnome, the trog tended his dials. There was a cacophony of static and electronic trash, blurred with the sharp howl of Morse. "The copy?" Nick asked, and the trog pushed a pad at him. Nick read off quickly. CTMZ, 0603, GMT, 72 degrees 16 south, 32 degrees 12 west. All ships in a position to render assistance. Please signify. CTMZ. He did not need to consult the RT handbook to recognize that call sign, CTMZ. With an effort of will, he controlled the pressure that caught him in the chest like a giant fist. It was as though he had lived this moment before. It was too neat. He forced himself to distrust his instinct, forced himself to think with his head and not his guts. Beyond him, he heard his officers' voices on the navigation bridge, quiet voices, but charged with tension. They were up from the saloon already. Christ, he thought savagely. How do they know so quickly? It was as though the ship itself had come awake beneath his feet and trembled with anticipation. The door from the bridge slid aside, and David Allen stood in the opening with a copy of Lloyd's Register in his hands. CTMZ, sir, is the call sign of the Golden Adventurer. 22,000 tons, registered Bermuda, 1975, owners Christie Marine. Thank you, number one. Nick nodded. Nicholas knew her well. He personally had ordered her construction before the collapse of the great liner traffic. Nick had planned to use her on the Europe to Australia run. Her finished cost had come in at $62 million, and she was a beautiful and graceful ship under her tall, light alloy superstructure. Her accommodation was luxurious, in the same class as the France or the United States. But she had been one of Nick's few miscalculations. When the feasibility of operation on the planned run had shown up prohibitive in the face of rising costs and diminishing trade, Nick had switched her usage. It was this type of flexible and intuitive planning and improvisation that had built Christy Marine into the Goliath she was now. Nick had innovated the idea of adventure cruises and changed the ship's name to the Golden Adventurer. Now she carried rich passengers to the wild and exotic corners of the globe, from the Galapagos Islands to the Amazon, from the remote Pacific Islands to the Antarctic, in search of the unusual. She carried guest lecturers with her, experts on the environments and ecology of the areas she was to visit. And she was equipped to take her passengers ashore to study the monoliths of Easter Island, or to watch the mating displays of the wandering albatross on the Falkland Islands. She was probably one of the very few cruise liners that was still profitable, and now she stood in need of assistance. Nicholas turned back from the trog. Has she been transmitting prior to this Signify request? She's been sending in company code since midnight. Her traffic was so heavy that I was watching her. The green glow of the sets gave the little man a bilious cast and made his teeth black so that he looked like an actor from a horror movie. You recorded? Nick demanded. And the trog switched on the automatic playback of his tape monitors, recapitulating every message the distress ship had sent or received since the previous night. The jumbled blocks of code poured into the room, and the paper strip printed out with the clatter of its keys. Had Duncan Alexander changed the Christy Marine code, Nick wondered. It would be the natural procedure, completely logical to any operations man. You lose a man who has the code, you change immediately. It was that simple. Duncan had lost Nick Berg. He should change. But Duncan was not an operations man. He was a figures and paper man. He thought in numbers, not in steel and salt water. If Duncan had changed, they would never break it. Not even with the Decker. Nick had devised the basis of the code. It was a projection that expressed the alphabet as a mathematical function based on a random six-figure master, changing the value of each letter on a progression that was impossible to monitor. Nick hurried out of the stinking gloom of the radio room with the printout in his hands. The navigation bridge of Warlock was gleaming chrome and glass, as bright and functional as a modern surgical theater or a futuristic kitchen layout. The primary control console stretched the full width of the bridge beneath the huge armored windows. The old-fashioned wheel was replaced by a single steel lever, and the remote control could be carried out onto the wings of the bridge on its long extension cable, like the remote on a television set, so that the helmsman could con the ship from any position he chose. Illuminated digital displays informed the master instantly of every condition of his ship. Speed across the bottom at bows and stern, speed through the water at bows and stern, wind direction and strength, together with all the other technical information of function and malfunction. Nick had built the ship with Christy money, and stinted not at all. The rear of the bridge was the navigational area, and the chart table divided it neatly with its overhead racks, containing the 106 big blue volumes of the Global Pilot, and as many other volumes of maritime publications. Below the table were the multiple drawers, wide and flat, to contain the spread Admiralty charts that covered every corner of navigable water on the globe. Against the rear bulkhead stood the battery of electronic navigational aids, like a row of fruit machines in a Vegas gambling hall. Nick switched the Big Decker satellite nav aid into its computer mode, and the display lights flashed and faded and relit in scarlet. He fed it the six-figure control, numbers governed by the moon phase and date of dispatch. The computer digested this instantaneously, and Dick gave it the last arithmetical proportion known to him. The Decker was ready to decode, and Nick gave it the block of garbled transmission and waited for it to throw back gibberish at him. Duncan must have altered the code. He stared at the printout. Christy Main, from Master of Adventurer, 2216 GMT, 72 degrees 16 south, 32 degrees 05 west. Underwater ice damage sustained midships starboard. Precautionary shutdown mains. Auxiliary generators activated during damage survey. Stand by. So Duncan had let the code stand there. Nick groped for the crocodile skin case of cheroots, and his hand was steady and firm as he held the flame to the top of the thin black tube. He felt the intense desire to shout aloud, but instead he drew the fragrant smoke into his lungs. "Plotted," said David Allen from behind him. Already on the spread chart of the Antarctic, he had marked the reported position. The transformation was complete. The first officer had become a grimly competent professional. There remained no trace of the high-colored undergraduate. Nick glanced at the plot, saw the dotted ice line far above the adventurer's position, saw the outline of the forbidding continent of Antarctica groping for the ship, with merciless fingers of ice and rock. The Decker printed out the reply. "Master of Adventurer from Christy Main, 2222 GMT, standing by." The next message from the recording tape was flagged nearly 2 hours later, but was printed out almost continuously from the Trog's recording. "Christy Main from Master of Adventurer, 0005 GMT, 72 degrees 18 south, 32 degrees 05 west. Water contained. Restarted mains. New course. Cape Town direct. Speed 8 knots. Stand by." Dave Allen worked swiftly with parallel rulers and protractor. While she was without power, she drifted 34 nautical miles south-southeast. "There's a hell of a wind or big current setting down there," he said, and the other deck officers were silent and strained. Although none of them would dare crowd the master at the Decker, yet in order of seniority, they had taken up vantage points around the bridge, best suited to follow the drama of a great ship in distress. The next message ran straight out from the computer, despite the fact that it had been dispatched many hours later. "Christy Main, from Master of Adventurer, 0546 GMT, 72 degrees 16 south, 32 degrees 12 west. Explosion in flooded area. Emergency shutdown all. Water gaining. Request your clearance to issue. All ships signify. Standing by." "Master of Adventurer from Christy Main, 0547 GMT. You are cleared to issue signify. Break, break, break. You are expressly forbidden to contract tow, or salvage without reference Christy Main. Acknowledge. Duncan was not even putting in the old chestnut, except in the event of danger to human life. The reason was too apparent. Christy Marine underwrote most of its own bottoms through another of its subsidiaries, the London and European Insurance and Finance Company. The self-insurance scheme had been the brainchild of Alexander Duncan himself when first he arrived at Christy Marine. Nick Berg had opposed the scheme bitterly, and now he might live to see his reasoning being justified. "Are we going to signify?" David Allen asked quietly. "Radio silence," snapped Nick irritably, and began to pace the bridge, the crack of his heels muted by the cork coating on the deck. "Is this my way?" Nick demanded of himself, applying the old rule he had set for himself long ago, the rule of deliberate thought first, action after. The Golden Adventurer was drifting in the ice fields, 2,000 and more miles south of Cape Town. 5 days and nights of hard running for the Warlock. If he made the go decision, by the time he reached her, she might have effected repairs and restarted. She might be under her own command again. Again, even if she was still helpless, Warlock might reach her to find another salvage tug had beaten her to the scene. So now it was time to call the roll. He stopped his pacing at the door to the radio room and spoke quietly to the trog. "Open the telex line and send to Barkwacky in Bermuda, quote, call the roll, unquote." As he turned away, Nick was satisfied with his own forethought in installing the satellite telex system, which enabled him to communicate with his agent in Bermuda, or with any other selected telex station, without his message being broadcast over the open frequencies and monitored by a competitor or any other interested party. His signals were bounced through the high stratosphere where they could not be intercepted. While he waited, Nicholas worried. The decision to go would mean abandoning the Esso oil rig tow. The tow fee had been a vital consideration in his cash flow situation. 220,000 sterling, without which he could not meet the quarterly interest payment due in 60 days' time. Unless... He juggled figures in his head, but the magnitude of the risk involved was growing momentarily more apparent. And the figures did not add up. He needed the Esso tow. God, how badly he needed it. "Barkwacky are replying," called the trog above the chatter of the telex receiver, and Nick spun on his heel. He had appointed Barkwacky as the agents for ocean salvage, because of their proven record of quick and aggressive efficiency. He glanced at his Rolex Oyster and calculated that it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, local time, in Bermuda, and yet his request for information on the disposition of all his major competitors was now being answered within minutes of receipt. "For Master Warlock, from Barkwacky, latest reported positions, John Ross, Dry Dock, Durban, Voltema, Voltarand, Esso Tow, Torres Straits, to Alaska Shelf." That took care of the two giant SAF marine tugs. Half of the top opposition was out of the race. "Vitesse, Shell Exploration, tow Galveston to North Sea. Grutase, lying breast." That was the two Dutchmen out of it. the names and positions of the other big salvage tugs. Each of them a direct and dire threat to Warlock. Ran swiftly from the telex, and Nicholas chewed his cheroot ragged as he watched. His eyes slitted against the spiraling blue smoke, feeling the relief rise in him as each report put another of his competitors in some distant waters, far beyond the range of the stricken ship. La Mouette. Nick's hands balled into fists as the name sprang onto the white paper sheet. La Mouette, discharged Bras Gasto, Golfo, San Jorge, on 14th, reported en route Buenos Aires. Nick grunted like a boxer, taking a low bow, and turned away from the machine. He walked out onto the open wing of the bridge, and the wind tore at his hair and clothing. La Mouette, the Seagull, a fanciful name for that black, squat hull, the old-fashioned high box of superstructure, the traditional single stack. Nick could see it clearly when he closed his eyes. There was no doubt in his mind at all. Jules Le Voisin was already running hard for the south, running like a hunting dog with the scent hot in his nostrils. Jules had discharged in the southern Atlantic 3 days ago. He would certainly have bunkered at Comodoro. Nick knew how Jules' mind worked. He was never happy unless his bunkers were bulging. Nick flicked the stub of his cigar away, and it was whisked far out into the harbour by the wind. He knew that La Mouette had refitted and installed new engines 18 months before. With a nostalgic twinge, he had read a snippet in Lloyd's List. But even 9,000 horsepower couldn't push that tubby hull at better than 18 knots. Nick was certain of that. Yet even with Warlock's superior speed, La Mouette was better placed by 1,000 miles. There was no room for complacency. And what if La Mouette had set out to double Cape Horn instead of driving north up the Atlantic? If that happened, and with Jules Le Voisin's luck it might have just have happened, then La Mouette was a long way inside him already. Anybody else but Jules Le Voisin, he thought. Why did it have to be him? And, oh God, why now? Why now, when I am so vulnerable, emotionally, physically, and financially vulnerable? Oh God, why did it come now? He felt the full sense of cheer and well-being with which he had buoyed himself that morning fall away from him like a cloak, leaving him naked and sick and tired again. I'm not ready yet, he thought. And then realized that it was probably the first time in his adult life that he'd ever said that to himself. He'd always been ready, good and ready for anything. But not now. Not this time. Suddenly, Nicholas Berg was afraid, as he had never been before. He was empty, he realized. There was nothing in him, no strength, no confidence, no resolve. The depth of his defeat by Duncan Alexander, the despair of his rejection by the woman he loved, had broken him. He felt his fear turn to terror, knowing that his wave had come and would sweep by him now, for he did not have the strength to ride it. Some deep instinct warned him that it would be the last wave. There would be nothing after it. The choice was go now or never go again. And he knew he could not go. He could not go against Jules Le Voisin. He could not challenge that old master. He could not go. He could not reject the certainty of the SO2. He did not have the nerve now to risk all that he had left on a single throw. He had just lost a big one. He couldn't go at risk again. The risk was too great. He was not ready for it. He did not have the strength for it. He wanted to go to his cabin and throw himself on his bunk and sleep. And sleep. He felt his knees buckling with the great weight of his despair, and he hungered for the oblivion of sleep. He turned back into the bridge and out of the wind. He was broken, defeated. He had given up. As he went towards the sanctuary of his day cabin, he passed the long command console and stopped involuntarily. His officers watched him in a tense electric silence. His right hand went out and touched the engine telegraph, sliding the pointer from off to standby. Engine room, he heard a voice speak in calm and level tones, so that it could not be his own. Start main engines, said the voice. Seemingly from a great distance, he watched the faces of his deck officers bloom with unholy joy, like old-time pirates savoring the prospect of a prize. The strange voice went on, echoing oddly in his ears. Number one, ask the harbour master for permission to steer harbour immediately. And pilot, course to steer for the last reported position of Golden Adventurer, please. From the corner of his eye, he saw David Allen punch the third officer lightly but gleefully on the shoulder before he hurried to the radio telephone. Nicholas Berg felt suddenly the urge to vomit. So he stood very still and erect at the navigation console and fought back the waves of nausea that swept over him, while his officers bustled to their seagoing stations. Bridge, this is the chief engineer, said a disembodied voice from the speaker above Nick's head. Main engines running. A pause, and then that word of special Aussie approbation. Beauty. But the chief pronounced it in three distinct syllables. Beauty. Warlock's wide-flared bows were designed to cleave and push the waters open ahead of her, and in those waters below latitude 40 degrees, she ran like an old bull otter, slick and wet and fast for the south. Uninterrupted by any landmass, the cycle of great atmospheric depressions swept endlessly across those cold open seas, and the wave patterns built up into a succession of marching mountain ranges. Warlock was taking them on her starboard shoulder, bursting through each crest in a white explosion that leapt from her bows like a torpedo strike, the water coming aboard green and clear over her high foredeck, and sweeping her from stem to stern as she twisted and broke out, dropping sheer into the valley that opened ahead of her. Her twin ferro-bronze propellers broke clear of the surface, the slamming vibration instantly controlled by the sophisticated variable pitch gear, until she swooped forward and the propellers bit deeply again, the thrust of the twin Merlis diesels hurtling her towards the slope of the next swell. Each time, it seemed that she could not rise in time to meet the cliff of water that bore down on her. The water was black under the grey, sunless sky. Nick had lived through typhoon and Caribbean hurricane, but he had never seen water as menacing and cruel as this. It glittered like the molten slag that pours down the dump of an iron foundry and cools to the same iridescent blackness. In the deep valleys between the crests, the wind was blanketed so they fell into an unnatural stillness, an eerie silence that only enhanced the menace of that towering slope of water. In the trough, Warlock heeled and threw our head up, climbing the slope in a gut-swooping lift that buckled the knees of the watch. As she went up, so the angle of her bridge tilted back, and that somber, cheerless sky filled the forward bridge windows with a vista of low scudding cloud. The wind tore at the crest of the wave ahead of her, ripping it away like cotton from the burst seams of a black mattress, splattering custard-thick spume against the armored glass. Then Warlock put her sharp steel nose deeply into it. Gouging a fat wedge of racing green over her head, twisting violently at the jarring impact, dropping sideways over the crest, and breaking out to fall free and repeat the cycle again. Nick was wedged into the canvas master's seat in the corner of the bridge. He swayed like a camel driver to the thrust of the sea and smoked his black cheroots quietly, his head turning every few minutes to the west, as though he expected at any moment to see the black, ugly hull of La Mouette come up on top of the next swell. But he knew she was 1,000 miles away still, racing down the far leg of the triangle, which had at its apex the stricken liner. If she is running, Nick thought, and knew that there was no doubt. La Mouette was running as frantically as was Warlock, and as silently. Jules Le Voisin had taught Nick the trick of silence. He would not use his radio until he had the liner in his radar scan. Then he would come through in clear. I will be in a position to put a line aboard you in 2 hours. Do you accept Lloyd's open form? The master of the distressed vessel, having believed himself abandoned without succor, would overreact to the promise of salvation, and when La Mouette came bustling up over the horizon, flying all her bunting, and with every light blazing in as theatrical a display as Jules could put up, the relieved master would probably leap at the offer of Lloyd's open form, a decision that would surely be regretted by the ship's owners in the cold and unemotional precincts of an arbitration court. When Nick had supervised the design of Warlock, he had insisted that she look good as well as being able to perform. The master of a disabled ship was usually a man in a highly emotional state. Mere physical appearance might sway him in the choice between 2 salvage tugs coming up on him. Warlock looked magnificent. Even in this cold and cheerless ocean, she looked like a warship. The trick would be to show her to the master of Golden Adventurer before he struck a bargain with La Mouette. Nick could no longer sit inactive in his canvas seat. He judged the next towering swell, and with 6 quick strides, crossed the bridge deck in those fleeting moments as Warlock steadied in the trough. He grabbed the chrome handrail above the Decker computer. On the keyboard, he typed the function code that would set the machine in navigational mode, coordinating the transmissions she was receiving with the circling satellite stations high above the Earth. From these were calculated Warlock's exact position over the Earth's surface, accurate to within 25 yards. Nick entered the ship's position, and the computer compared this with the plot that Nick had requested 4 hours previously. It printed out quickly the distance run, and the ship's speed made good. Nick frowned angrily and swung round to watch the helmsman. In this fiercely running cross sea, a good man could hold Warlock on course more efficiently than any automatic steering device. He could anticipate each trough and crest and prevent the ship paying off across the direction of the swells, and then kicking back violently as she went over, wasting critical time and distance. Nick watched the helmsman work, judging each sea as it came aboard, checking the ship's heading on the big repeating compass above the man's head. After 10 minutes, Nick realized that there was no wastage. Warlock was making as good a course as was possible in these conditions. The engine tachograph was pulled back to her maximum safe power setting. The course was good, and yet Warlock was not delivering those few extra knots of speed that Nick Berg had relied on when he had made the critical decision to race Lamouette for the prize. Nick had relied on 28 knots against the Frenchman's 18, and he was not getting it. Involuntarily, he glanced out to the west as Warlock came up on the top of the next crest. Through the streaming windows, from which the spinning wipers cleared circular areas of clean glass, Nick looked out across a wilderness of black water, forbidding and cold and devoid of other human presence. Abruptly, Nick crossed to the RT microphone. "Engine room, confirm we are top of the green." "Top of the green it is, Skipper." The chief's casual tones floated in above the crash of the next sea coming aboard. Top of the green was the maximum safe power setting recommended by the manufacturers for those gigantic Merlus diesels. It was a far higher setting than top economical power, and they were burning fuel at a prodigious rate. Nick was pushing her as high as he could without going into the red danger area, above 80% of full power, which at prolonged running might permanently damage her engines. Nick turned away to his seat and wedged himself into it. He groped for his cheroot case and then checked himself, the lighter in his hand. His tongue and mouth felt furred over and dry. He had smoked without a break every waking minute since leaving Cape Town, and God knows he had slept little enough since then. He ran his tongue around his mouth with distaste before he returned the cheroot to his case, and crouched in his seat, staring ahead, trying to work out why Warlock was running slow. Suddenly he straightened and considered a possibility that brought a metallic green gleam of anger into Nick's eyes. He slid out of his seat, nodded to the third officer, who had the deck, and ducked through the doorway in the back of the bridge into his day cabin. It was a ploy. He didn't want his visit below decks announced, and from his own suite, he darted into the companionway. The engine control room was as modern and gleaming as Warlock's navigation bridge. It was completely enclosed with double glass to cut down the thunder of her engines. The control console was banked below the windows, and all the ship's functions were displayed in green and red digital figures. The view beyond the windows into the main engine room was impressive, even for Nick, who had designed and supervised each foot of the layout. The two Merlis diesel engines filled the white-painted cavern with only walking space between. Each as long as 4 Cadillac Eldorados parked bumper to bumper, and as deep as if another 4 Cadillacs had been piled on top of them. The 36 cylinders of each block were crowned with a moving forest of valve stems and conrod ends, each enormous powerhouse capable of pouring out 11,000 usable horsepower. It was only custom that made it necessary for any visitor, including the master, to announce his arrival in the engine room to the chief engineer. Ignoring custom, Nick slipped quietly through the glass sliding doors. Out of the hot, burned oil stench of the engine room, into the cooler and sweeter conditioned air of the control room. Vin Baker was deep in conversation with one of his electricians. Both of them kneeling before the open doors of one of the tall grey steel cabinets, which housed a teeming mass of coloured cables and transistor switches. Nick had reached the control console before the chief engineer uncoiled his lanky body from the floor and spun round to face him. When Nick was very angry, his lips compressed in a single thin white line. The thin, dark eyebrows seemed to meet above the snapping green eyes and large, slightly beaked nose. "You pulled the override on me," he accused in a flat, passionless voice that did not betray his fury. "You're governing her out of 70% of power." "That's top of the green in my book," Vin Baker told him. "I'm not running my engines at 80% in this sea. She'll shake the guts out of herself." He paused, and the stern was flung up violently as Warlock crashed over the top of another sea. The control room shuddered with the vibration of the screws breaking out of the surface, spinning wildly in the air before they could bite again. "Listen to our man. You want me to pour on more of it?" "She's built to take it." "Nothing's built to run that hard and live in this sea." "I want the override out," said Nick flatly, indicating the chrome handle and pointer with which the engineer could cancel the power settings asked for by the bridge. "I don't care when you do it, just as long as it's any time within the next 5 seconds. You get out of my engine room and go play with your toys." "All right," Nick nodded. "I'll do it myself." And he reached for the override gear. "You take your hands off my engines," howled Vin Baker, and picked up the iron locking handle off the deck. "You touch my engines, and I'll break your teeth out of your head, you ice-cold pummy bastard." Even in his own anger, Nick blinked at the epithet. When he thought about the blazing passions and emotions that seethed within him, he nearly laughed aloud. "Ice cold," he thought. "So that's how he sees me." "You stupid Bundaberg swilling gala," he said quietly as he reached for the override. "I don't really care if I have to kill you first, but we're going to 80%. It was Vin Baker's turn to blink behind his smeared glasses. He had not expected to be insulted in the colloquial. He dropped the heavy steel handle to the deck. It fell with a clang. "I don't need it," he announced, and tucked his spectacles into his back pocket and hoisted his trousers with both elbows. "It'll be more fun to take you to pieces by hand." It was only then that Nick realized how tall the engineer was. His arms were ridged with the lean, wiry, taut muscle of hard physical labor. His fists, as he balled them, were lumpy with scar tissue across the knuckles and the size of a pair of 9-pound hammers. He went down into a fighter's crouch and rode the plunging deck with an easy flexing of the long, powerful legs. As Nicholas touched the chrome override handle, the first punch came from the level of Baker's knees. But it came so fast that Nick only just had time to sway away from it. It whistled up past his jaw and scraped the skin from the outside corner of his eye. But he counterpunched instinctively, swaying back and slamming it in under the armpit, feeling the blow land so solidly that his teeth jarred his own head. The chief's breath hissed, but he swung left-handed, and a bony fist crushed the pad of muscle on the point of Nick's shoulder, bounced off, and caught him high on the temple. Even though it was a glancing blow, it felt as though a door had slammed in Nick's head, and resounding darkness closed behind his eyes. He fell forward into a clinch to ride the darkness, grabbing the lean, hard body and smothering it in a bear hug as he tried to clear the singing darkness in his head. He felt the chief shift his weight and was shocked at the power in that wiry frame. It took all his own strength to hold him. Suddenly and clearly, he knew what was going to happen next. There were little white ridges of scar tissue, half hidden by the widow's peak of flopping sandy hair on the chief's forehead. Those scars from previous conflicts warned Nick. Vin Baker reared back, like a cobra flaring for the strike, and then flung his head forward. It was the classic butt, aimed for Nick's face, and had it landed squarely, it would have crushed in his nose and broken his teeth off level to the gums. But Nick anticipated and dropped his own chin, tucking it down hard so that their foreheads met with a crack like a breaking oak branch. The impact broke Nick's grip, and both of them reeled apart across the heaving deck, Vin Baker howling like a moonsick dog and clutching his own head. "Fight fair, you pummy bastard!" he howled in outrage, and he came up short against the steel cabinets that lined the far side of the control room. The astonished electrician dived for cover under the control console, scattering tools across the deck. Vin Baker lay for a moment, gathering his lanky frame. And then as Warlock swung hard over, rolling viciously in the cross sea, he used her momentum to hurl himself down the steeply tilting deck, dropping his head again like a battering ram to crush in Nick's ribs as he charged. Nick turned like a cattleman working an unruly steer. He whipped one arm round Vin Baker's neck and ran with him, holding his head down and building up speed across the full length of the control room. They reached the armored glass wall at the far end, and the top of Vin Baker's head was the point of impact with the weight of both their bodies behind it. The chief engineer came round at the prick of the needle that Angel forced through the thick flap of open flesh on top of his head. He came round fighting drunkenly, but the cook held him down with one huge hairy arm. "Easy, love." Angel pulled the needle through the torn red weeping scalp and tied the stitch. "Where is he? Where is the bastard?" slurred the chief. "It's all over, chiefy," Angel told him gently. "And you are lucky he bashed you on the head, otherwise he might have hurt you." He took another stitch. The chief winced as Angel pulled the thread up tight and knotted it. "He tried to mess with my engines. I taught the bastard a lesson." "You've terrified him," Angel agreed sweetly. "Now you take a swig of this and lie still. I want you in this bunk for 12 hours, and I might come and tuck you in." "I'm going back to my engines," announced the chief, and drained the medicine glass of brown spirit, then whistled at the bite of the fumes. Angel left him and crossed to the telephone. He spoke quickly into it, and as the chief lumbered off the bunk, Nick Berg stepped into the cabin and nodded to the cook. "Thank you, Angel." Angel ducked out of the cabin and left them facing each other. The chief opened his mouth to snarl at Nick. "Jules de Voisin in La Mouette has probably made 500 miles in us while you've been playing prima donna," said Nick quietly. And Vin Baker's mouth stayed open, although no sound came out of it. "I built this ship to run fast and hard in just this kind of contest. And now you're trying to do us all out of our prize money." Nick turned on his heel and went back up the companionway to his navigation deck. He settled into his canvas chair and fingered the big purple swelling on his forehead tenderly. His head felt as though a rope had been knotted around it and twisted up tight. He wanted to go to his cabin and take something for the pain, but he did not wish to miss the call when it came. He lit another cheroot, and it tasted like burned, tarred rope. He dropped it into the sandbox, and the telephone at his shoulder rang once. "Bridge, this is the engine room."
"Go ahead, Chief."
"We are going to 80% now." Nick did not reply, but he felt the change in the engine vibration and the more powerful rush of the hull beneath them.
"Nobody told me Lamouette was running against us. No way that frog-eating bastard's going to get a line on her first," announced Vin Baker grimly, and there was silence between them. Something more had to be said.
"I'll bet you a pound to a pinch of kangaroo dung," challenged the chief, "that you don't know what a gala is, and that you've never tasted a Bundaberg rum in your life."
Nick found himself smiling, even through the blinding pain in his head.
"Beauty,"
Nick said, making three syllables of it and keeping the laughter out of his voice as he hung up the receiver. Dave Allen's voice was apologetic.
"Sorry to wake you, sir, but the Golden Adventurer is reporting."
"I'm coming,"
mumbled Nick, and swung his legs off the bunk. He had been in that black death sleep of exhaustion, but it took him only seconds to pull back the dark curtains from his mind. It was his old training as a watchkeeping officer. He rubbed away the last traces of sleep, feeling the rasping black stubble of his beard under his fingers as he crossed quickly to his bathroom. He spent 40 seconds in bathing his face and combing his tousled hair, and regretfully decided there was no time to shave. Another rule of his was to look good in a world which so often judged a man by his appearance. When he went out onto the navigation bridge, he knew at once that the wind had increased its velocity. He guessed it was rising 4-6 now, and Warlock's motion was more violent and abandoned. Beyond the warm, dimly lit capsule of the bridge, all those elements of cold water and vicious racing winds turned the black night to a howling tumult. The Trog was crouched over his machines, grey and wizened and sleepless. He hardly turned his head to hand Nick the message flimsy. "Master of Golden Adventurer to Christie Main," the Decker decoded swiftly, and Nick grunted as he saw the new position report. Something had altered drastically in the liner's circumstances. Main engines still unserviceable. Current setting easterly and increasing to 8 knots. Wind rising 4-6 from northwest. Critical ice danger to the ship. What assistance can I expect? There was a panicky note to that last line, and Nick saw why when he compared the liner's new position on the spread chart.
"She's going down sharply on the lee shore," David muttered as he worked quickly over the chart. "The current and wind are working together. They're driving her down onto the land."
He touched the ugly broken points of Coatsland's shoreline with the tip of one finger. "She's 80 miles offshore now. At the rate she's drifting, it'll take her only another 10 hours before she goes ground."
"If she doesn't hit an iceberg first," said Nick.
"From the master's last message, it sounds as though they are into big ice."
"That's a cheerful thought," agreed David, and straightened up from the chart.
"What's our time to reach her?"
"About 40 hours, sir."
David hesitated and pushed the thick, white gold lock of hair off his forehead. "If we can make good this speed,
but we may have to reduce when we reach the ice." Nick turned away to his canvas chair. He felt the need to pace back and forward, to release the pent-up forces within him. However, any movement in this heavy, pounding sea was not only difficult, but downright dangerous. So he groped his way to the chair and wedged himself in, staring ahead into the clamorous black night. He thought about the terrible predicament of the liner's captain. His ship was at deadly risk, and the lives of his crew and passengers with it. How many lives? Nick cast his mind back and came up with the figures. The Golden Adventurer's full complement of officers and crew was 235, and there was accommodation for 375 passengers, a possible total of over 600 souls. If the ship was lost, Warlock would be hard put to take aboard that huge press of human life. "Well, sir, they signed on for adventure." David Allen spoke into his thoughts as though he'd heard them. "And they're getting their money's worth." Nick glanced at him and nodded. "Most of them will be elderly. A berth on that cruise costs a fortune, and it's usually only the oldsters who've got that sort of gold. If she goes aground, we're going to lose life." "With respect, Captain." David hesitated and blushed again for the first time since leaving port. "If her captain knows that assistance is on the way, it may prevent him doing something crazy." Nick was silent. The mate was right, of course. It was cruel to leave them in the despair of believing that they were alone down there in those terrible ice fields. The adventurer's captain could make a panic decision, one that could be averted if he knew how close succor was. "The air temperature out there is -5 degrees, and if the wind is at 30 miles an hour, that will make it a lethal chill factor. If they take to the boats in that..." David was interrupted by the trog calling from the radio room. "The owners are replying." It was a long message that Christy Marine was sending to their captain. It was filled with those same hollow assurances that a surgeon gives a cancer patient. But one paragraph had relevance for Nick. "All efforts being made to contact salvage tugs reported operating South Atlantic." David Allen looked at him expectantly. It was the right, humane thing to do. To tell them he was only 800 miles away and closing swiftly. Nervous energy fizzed in Nick's blood, making him restless and angry. On an impulse, he left his chair and carefully crossed the heaving deck to the starboard wing of the bridge. He slid open the door and stepped out into the gale. The shock of that icy air took his breath away, and he gasped like a drowning man. He felt tears streaming from his eyes across his cheeks, and the frozen spray struck into his face like steel darts. Carefully, he filled his lungs, and his nostrils flared as he smelt to the ice. It was that unmistakable dank smell he remembered so well from the northern Arctic seas. It was like the body smell of some gigantic reptilian sea monster, and it struck the mariner's chill into his soul. He could endure only a few seconds more of the gale, but when he stepped back into the cozy, green-lit warmth of the bridge, his mind was clear and he was thinking crisply. "Mr. Allen, there is ice ahead." "I have a watch on the radar, sir." "Very good." Nick nodded. "But we'll reduce to 50% of power." He hesitated and then went on, "and maintain radio silence." The decision was hard made, and Nick saw the accusation in David Allen's eyes before he turned away to give the orders for the reduction in power. Nick felt a sudden and uncharacteristic urge to explain the decision to him. He did not know why. Perhaps he needed the mate's understanding and sympathy. Instantly, Nick saw that as a symptom of his weakness and vulnerability. He never needed sympathy before, and he steeled himself against it now. His decision to maintain radio silence was correct. He was dealing with two hard men. He knew he could not afford to give an inch of sea room to Jules Lavoisin. He would force him to open radio contact first. He needed that advantage. The other man with whom he had to deal was Duncan Alexander, and he was a hating man, dangerous and vindictive. He had tried once to destroy Nick, and perhaps he'd already succeeded. Nick had to guard himself now. He must pick with care his moment to open negotiations with Christy Marine and the man who had displaced him as his head. Nick must be in a position of utmost strength when he did so. Jules Lavoisin must be forced to declare himself first, Nick decided. The captain of the Golden Adventurer would have to be left in the agonies of doubt a little longer. And Nick consoled himself with the thought that any further drastic change in the line of circumstances, or a decision by the master to abandon his ship and commit his company to the lifeboats, would be announced on the open radio channels and would give him a chance to intervene. Nick was about to caution the Trog to keep a particular watch on Channel 16 for Lamouette's first transmission. Then he checked himself. That was another thing he never did, issue unnecessary orders. The Trog's grey wrinkled head was wreathed in clouds of reeking cigar smoke, but was bowed to his mass of electronic equipment, and he adjusted a dial with a careful lover's fingers. His little eyes were bright and sleepless as those of an ancient sea turtle. Nick went to his chair and settled down to wait out the few remaining hours of the short Antarctic summer night. The radar screen had shown strange and alien capes and headlands above the sea clutter of the storm. Strange islands, anomalies which did not relate to the Admiralty charts. Between these alien masses shone myriad other smaller contacts, bright as fireflies, any one of which could have been the echo of a stricken ocean liner, but which was not. As Warlock nosed cautiously down into this enchanted sea, the dawn, that had never been far from the horizon, flushed out, timorous as a bride, decked in colours of gold and pink that struck splendorous splinters of light off the icebergs. The horizon ahead of them was cluttered with ice. Some of the fragments were but the size of a billiard table, and they bumped and scraped down the Warlock's side, then swung and bobbed in her wake as she passed. There were others the size of a city block, weird and fanciful structures of honeycombed white ice that stood as tall as Warlock's upper works as she passed. "White ice is soft ice," Nick murmured to David Allen beside him, and then caught himself. It was an unnecessary speech, inviting familiarity, and before the mate could answer, Nick turned quickly away to the radar repeater and lowered his face to the eyepiece in the coned hood. For a minute, he studied the images of the surrounding ice in the darkened body of the instrument, then went back to his seat and stared ahead impatiently. Warlock was running too fast. Nick knew it. He was relying on the vigilance of his deck officers to carry her through the ice. Yet still this speed was too slow for his seething impatience. Above the horizon rose another shoreline, a great unbroken sweep of towering cliff which caught the low sun and glowed in emerald and amethyst. A drifting tableland of solid, hard ice, 40 miles across and 200 feet high. As they closed with that massive, translucent island, so the colors that glowed through it became more hauntingly beautiful. The cliffs were rent by deep bays and split by crevasses whose shadowy depths were dark sapphire, blue and mysterious, paling out to 1,000 shades of green. "My God, it's beautiful," said David Allen, with the reverence of a man kneeling in a cathedral. The crests of the ice cliffs blazed in clearest ruby. To windward, the big sea piled in and crashed against those cliffs, surging up them in explosive bursts of white spray. Yet the iceberg did not dip, nor swing, or work, even in that murderous sea. "Look at the lee she's making," Dave Allen pointed. "You could ride out a force 12 behind her." On the leeward side, the waters were protected from the wind by that mountain of sheer ice. Green and docile, they lapped those mysterious blue cliffs. And Warlock went into the lee, passing in a ship's length from the plunging, rearing action of a wild horse into the tranquility of a mountain lake, calm, windless, and unnatural. In the calm, Angel brought trays piled with crisp, brown-baked Cornish pasties and steaming mugs of thick, creamy cocoa. And they ate breakfast at 3 in the morning, marveling at the fine, pale sunlight and the towers of incredible beauty. The younger officers shouting and laughing when a school of 5 black killer whales passed so close that they could see their white cheek patterns and wide grinning mouths through the icy clear waters. The great mammals circled the ship, then ducked beneath her hull, surging up on the far side with their huge black triangular fins shearing the surface as they blew through the vents in the top of their heads. The fishy stink of their breath pervaded the bridge, and then they were gone, and Warlock motored calmly along in the lee of the ice, like a holiday launch of day trippers. Nicholas Berg did not join the spontaneous gaiety. He munched one of Angel's delicious pies, full of meat and thick gravy, but he could not finish it. His stomach was too tense. He found himself resenting the high spirits of his officers. The laughter offended him, now when his whole life hung in precarious balance. He felt the temptation to quell them with a few harsh words, conscious of the power he had to plunge them into instant consternation. Nick listened to their carefree banter and felt old enough to be their father, despite the few years' difference in their ages. He was impatient with them, irritated they should be able to laugh like this when so much was at stake. 600 human lives, a great ship, tens of millions of dollars, his whole future. They would probably never themselves know what it felt like to put a lifetime's work at risk on a single flip of the coin. And then, suddenly, unaccountably, he envied them. He could not understand the sensation, could not fathom why suddenly he longed to laugh with them, to share the companionship of the moment, to be free of pressure for just a little while. For 15 years, he had not known that sort of hiatus, had never wanted it. He stood up abruptly, and immediately the bridge was silent. Every officer concentrating on his appointed task, not one of them glancing at him as he paced once, slowly, across the wide bridge. It did not need a word to change the mood, and suddenly Nick felt guilty. It was too easy, too cheap. Carefully, Nick steeled himself, shutting out the weakness, building up his resolve and determination, bringing all his concentration to bear on the Herculean task ahead of him. And he paused at the door of the radio room. The Trog looked up from his machines, and they exchanged a single glance of understanding. Two completely dedicated men, with no time for frivolity. Dick nodded and paced on, the strong, handsome face stern and uncompromising, his step firm and measured. But when he stopped again by the side windows of the bridge and looked up at the magnificent cliff of ice, he felt the doubts surging up again within him. How much had he sacrificed for what he had gained? How much joy and laughter had he spurned to follow the high road of challenge? How much beauty had he passed along the way without seeing it in his haste? How much love and warmth and companionship? He thought with a fierce pang of the woman who had been his wife, and who had gone now with the child who was his son. Why had they gone? And what had they left him with, after all his strivings? Behind him, the radio crackled and hummed as the carrier beam opened Channel 16. Then it pitched higher as a human voice came through in clear. Mayday! 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 This is Golden Adventurer. Nick spun and ran to the radio room as the calm, masculine voice read out the coordinates of the ship's position. We are in imminent danger of striking. We are preparing to abandon ship. Can any vessel render assistance? Repeat, can any vessel render assistance?
Good God.
Dave Allen's voice was harsh with anxiety. The currents got them. They're going down on Cape Alarm at 9 knots. She's only 50 miles offshore, and we're still 220 miles from that position.
Where is Lamouette?
Growled Nick Berg.
Where the hell is she?
We'll have to open contact now, sir. David Allen looked up from the chart. You can't let them go down into the boats. Not in this weather, sir. It would be murder.
Thank you, Number One, said Nick quietly. Your advice is always welcome.
David flushed, but there was anger and not embarrassment beneath the colour. Even in the stress of the moment, Nick noted that and adjusted his position of the first officer. He had guts as well as brains. The mate was right, of course. There was only one thing to consider now, the conservation of human life. Nick looked up at the top of the ice cliff and saw the low cloud tearing off it, roiling and swirling in the wind, pouring down over the edge like boiling milk frothing from the lip of a grape pot. He had to send now. Lamouette had won the contest of silence. Nick stared up at the cloud and composed the message he would send. He must reassure the master, urge him to delay his decision to abandon ship, and give Warlock the time to close the gap, perhaps even reach her before she struck on Cape Alarm. The silence on the bridge was deepened by the absence of wind. They were all watching him now, waiting for the decision, and in that silence the carrier beam of Channel 16 hummed and throbbed. Then, suddenly, a rich Gallic accent poured into the silent bridge, a full, fruity voice that Nick remembered so clearly, even after all the years.
Master of Golden Adventurer, this is the master of Salvage Tug Lamouette. I am proceeding at best speed your assistance. Do you accept Lloyd's open form? No cure, no pay.
Nick kept his face from showing any emotion, but his heart barged wildly against his ribs. Jules Levoisin had broken silence. Plot his position report, he said quietly.
God, she's inside us.
David Allen's face was stricken as he marked Lamouette's reported position on the chart.
She's 100 miles ahead of us.
No. Nick shook his head. He's lying. Sir? He's lying. He always lies. Nick lit a cheroot. When it was drawing evenly, he spoke again to his radio officer. Did you get a bearing? And the Trog looked up from his radio direction finding compass, on which he was tracing Lamouette's transmissions. I've only one coordinate. You won't get a fix. But Nick interrupted him. We'll use his best course from Golfo San Jorge for a fix. He turned back to David Allen. Plot that. There's a difference of over 300 nautical miles. Yes, Nick nodded. That old pirate wouldn't broadcast an accurate position to all the world. We are inside him and running 5 knots better. We'll put a line over Golden Adventurer before he's in radar contact. Are you going to open contact with Christy Main now, sir? No, Mr. Allen. But they will do a deal with Lamouette unless we bid now. I don't think so, Nick murmured, and almost went on to say, Duncan Alexander won't settle for Lloyd's open form while he's the underwriter and his ship is free and floating. He'll fight for daily hire and bonus, and Jules Levoisin won't buy that package. He'll hold out for the big plum. They won't do a deal until the two ships are in visual contact, and by that time I'll have her in tow and I'll fight the bastard in the awards court for 25% of her value. But he did not say it. Steady as she goes, Mr. Allen, was all he said as he left the bridge. He closed the door of his day cabin and leaned back against it, shutting his eyes tightly as he gathered himself. It had been so very close, a matter of seconds, and he would have declared himself and given the advantage to Lamouette. Through the door behind him, he heard David Allen's voice. Did you see him? He didn't feel a thing. Not a bloody thing. He was going to let those poor bastards go into the boats. He must piss ice water. The voice was muffled, but the outrage in it was tempered by awe. Nick kept his eyes shut a moment longer. Then he straightened up and pushed himself away from the door. He wanted it to begin now. It was the waiting and the uncertainty which was eroding what was left of his strength. Please God, let me reach them in time. And he was not certain whether it was for the lives or for the salvage award that he was praying.